Some of our country's deepest divides are about sexual morality. And religion scholar Marie Griffith's latest book says that debate ultimately comes down to change versus tradition.
You know, we see over time these kind of two sides crystallizing in some way. And one of them is really very fearful that if you open up and loosen sexual morality and gender roles and things like that, ultimately America will fall apart.
And how does one Washington journalist see this current political moment?
I don't know whether in the presidency of Donald Trump, we're in a truly abnormal moment. It's certainly unique, it's certainly different than anything we've experienced. I don't know whether it's abnormal or the beginning of a new normal.
That's Washington Post chief correspondent Dan Baltz speaking to Harvard's Kennedy School. He joins us. Plus, researchers at Northwestern have learned more about why infants and children develop food allergies. It's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. In 1969, a survey of Texas Baptists revealed that 90% felt their state's abortion laws should be loosened. So when did these beliefs about abortion in particular become such a change in American life and politics when we're thinking about religion? That's the topic of a new book by Marie Griffith. She's the director of the Danforth Center on Religion and Politics at Washington University. And the book is called Moral Combat: How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics. It's an exploration of gender roles, sexual identity, and how that's played out in our politics. She was in Central Illinois yesterday for a lecture at the University of Illinois, and she joined me in our Urbana studios yesterday afternoon to talk about her book. Marie, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Oh, great to be here.
So you make the argument that sex and issues around sexuality, whether we're talking about same-sex marriage or gender identity or women's rights, including the right to have an abortion, all of this is really a proxy for really a discussion or an argument about change, and it's sort of a battle of change versus tradition. Can you explain a little bit more what you mean by that?
Yeah, absolutely. If you look back really over the past century, back even to the birth control movement, you can see that these issues come up over and over again around sex and sexuality and gender. And one reason I wrote the book was to ask the question, why is that? Why are Americans constantly battling over sex in our churches and in our politics? And so exactly as you said, what I came to realize was that these aren't so much only battles over sexual morality. They're certainly that, but they're really about a fear of change versus a kind of attitude of welcoming change and progress. So, you know, we see over time these kind of two sides crystallizing in some way. And one of them is really very fearful that if you open up and loosen sexual morality and gender roles and things like that, ultimately, America will fall apart. I mean, that fear has been sort of articulated over and over again. And whereas the other side that's kind of coalesced over the years, the progressive side, is really thinking about this in terms of inclusivity, rather, and opening the door and you know, equality and justice for everyone. So you really have very competing attitudes toward change and tradition.
And there is the fear in that, and there's also the historical context. But I wonder, there's also this sort of this notion of God talk. And I do think everyone, why do you think we're so interested in Americans as we always want to claim God is on our side? Mm. And even though this is a country that's sort of founded on the separation of church and state, you write about this, that this idea of God supporting us is also something that's really important to us.
Yes. Well, and this is a theme really that goes way back in our history, a sort of American, and you know, there's a bit of hubris to it, as I think you're suggesting, that somehow we can imagine what God's will is and live that out. And I am sorry to say, I did see that over and over again among Americans in the churches who were absolutely certain of one side or the other, you know, of kind of where God stood, quote unquote, on a particular issue. And this comes, you know, for many people, it comes from their reading of the Bible or from their understanding of the history of church doctrine and other kinds of things. But it's really remarkable how certain, you know, people can be about issues that for some of us reading the Bible don't look all that certain, really.
And do you think those are related, that fear of change versus the notion that God has to be on our side?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that oftentimes the fear of change does go with a sort of sense of this is what God wants, you know, and God wants us to be sexually pure within marriage. He only wants marriage to be between one man and one woman. You know, men should sort of be the heads of the households and women sort of obeying. Of course, abortion is out of bounds. All of these kinds of ideas tend to go with a sort of certainty that these rules are in the Bible and that God has laid them down absolutely clearly, with utter clarity. And anyone who questions that is a sinner or simply deceived in their reading of the Bible and tradition.
My guest is Marie Griffith. She's the author of a book called Moral Combat, How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics. And so you talk about fear as fear of being this driving force, but then you kind of go into the different kinds of fears. And you really, I think it's not just a fear of change, but there's a couple other things going on here, including fear of people who don't look like us. Mm-hmm. And you think, how does that get reflected in all of this?
Yeah, I sort of write about three fears in particular that I kind of discern throughout all of this. The first is really a fear of women and particularly women's power and in particular women's sexual power and sexual freedom, women's ability to sort of control their own lives, you might say. The second is a fear of sort of people who don't look like us. It's often racialized. Sometimes it's in a religious context. There's a long Protestant fear of Catholics in America, for instance, and today's big fear often is seems to be of Muslims in some quarters. And then the third is what I mentioned earlier, this fear that somehow America is going to fall into decline as a result of sexual sin, ultimately. And these three fears crop up in this stuff over and over again, and oftentimes Christian leaders are sort of stoking, I think, those fears in their people, in the pews, very effectively. And it's a very effective tool for political mobilization.
And so you write that in a historical context, the debate doesn't seem to be as intractable as it is now. Mm-hmm. And that's the crux of your work, trying to understand the historical context of this. And so as we've sort of described, almost it's almost as if there's two different religions of Christianity when you look at the right versus the left. You write that this actually stemmed from the modern day right women's rights movement. Can you take us back to that and why you think that's where this started?
Yeah, I really do sort of think it all sort of started with suffrage in a way. I don't mean that overly simplistically, but, you know, when women got the right to vote in 1920, it was a profoundly controversial thing.
When white women got the right.
White women, absolutely, right. Yes. And I do say that. I point that out right. In the book. But you're absolutely right. So when white women got the right to vote in 1920, it was profoundly controversial. And there were plenty of people, women and men, who did not want women's rights, did not want women to have the right to vote, thought that this was a terrible path for the country to go down. And from there, you know, these fights over gender and power and sex just escalated over time. And as you say, these aren't debates so much between religious people versus secular people, although sometimes they look like that too. But they're really deep debates within Christianity itself, within Protestant communities and Catholic communities, and then between Protestants and Catholics oftentimes. So you have this internal debate over what it means to be a Christian and what Christian morality consists of that deepens and deepens over time and comes really to define our politics in all kinds of ways.
And you think this is because this comes back to interpretations of Christianity and the role of men and women.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I think it comes down to women's roles, but, you know, just also a sense of should women be sexually pure? Is that crucial for sort of Christian virtue and that sort of thing? And whereas for progressive Christians, they would say those things don't matter. What matters about the Christian life is caring for the poor, seeking justice for all people, equality. It's really, you know, two very different ways of thinking about what is central to Christian faith.
And then I wanted to ask you about the racial component of mm-hmm. it. Why was it important for you to make the distinction that the women's rights, the right for women to vote was particularly around white women.
Right. So I would say that race has been a key component of all of these debates all along the way. And as we know, there's not American history is drenched in racial politics and fights about racism and racial justice and all of that. So from the very beginning, yes, part of the, frankly, the impetus against the suffrage movement was the fear that black women would also get the right to vote. And Southern Jim Crow white and white people, men and women, made that argument over and over again, you know, very vocally. So they're very open about it. But, you know, race also has mattered in the abortion debate. It mattered in the birth control debate. So the sort of fear that this opening of sexual morality, again, it's not just about women, but about the fear of sort of black sexuality, you know, oftentimes.
And so that brings us to, as we're talking about this, I can't help but think of the 2016 election. And you write that history would dictate that you think people voted for President Trump not in spite of his views of women or the stories of how he treated women, but actually because of that, including the majority of white women, the white female vote that he got. Can you explain the historical context of that?
Sure. And let me just clarify, I certainly don't mean to say that the election came down only to women and gender politics. There were many other issues, too. But I absolutely think that people who were drawn to Trump in many ways were drawn to that kind of, you know, what people interpreted at least as a kind of masculine, you know, no holds barred kind of macho personality and style of politics over and against feminism, which is what Hillary Clinton really represented. So, you know, I think that people kept asking the question, why are evangelicals supporting Trump, or why are these conservative Christians who are so consumed about sexual morality supporting a philandering adulterer who's done the kinds of things he's done? And I think part of the reason for that was there was just all this gender hierarchy bound up in that. It was about what we used to call patriarchy, right? That he's kind of just representing a kind of masculine guy that I guess some men would like to be themselves.
And women also want.
They do. I mean, that's a harder one to explain. And it was hard to explain with Roy Moore a few months later, right? And that election in Alabama, which he lost barely, but he won in the white women's vote in Alabama again. So, you know, I think it really does. There's a certain, you know, misogyny that's bound up in this. I'm sorry. I think that is just absolutely the case. And you can see it when you see the kinds of critiques that were made of Hillary Clinton. Again, the embodiment of a feminist, you know, woman who was independent and pro-choice and equal and all of that. There was a preference ultimately for the sort of Trumpian character, regardless of morality.
So your book came out in 2017, and you write at the end of the book about the backlash to this. And I'm thinking about the Women's March, which you write about, but I'm also thinking about the many women we're now seeing running for office. Has it surprised you?
No. It's made me happy personally, because you really see this galvanizing effect, right, of people saying, wait a minute, we've been asleep here. And, you know, we need to make sure that we take a public stand in favor of women's rights, in favor of immigrants and other people that Trump was talking against and very badly about, in take a stand for African-Americans and for racial justice in this country and for Black Lives Matter. So, you know, I think it's had this tremendously galvanizing effect, both in the national and local marches that have been going on around the country, but also, as you say, in candidates and voting patterns. And, you know, these midterm elections coming up are going to be really, really interesting.
And I also wanted to ask you about the Me Too movement, mm-hmm. which has also happened in the past 6 months. And we've seen this outpouring of stories of people sharing their stories of sexual assault, of sexual harassment. And that's even happening in churches. And I mentioned in particular here in Illinois, the pastor of the very popular evangelical megachurch, Willow Creek, he just announced he's stepping down early this week amid allegations of sexual misconduct. Where do you see the Me Too movement in all of this?
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, that's very interesting. The Bill Hybels story is who you're mm-hmm. referring to. And, of course, Hybels, in his sort of speech to his congregation, stood up, I believe, with his wife and his family.
He did, this week.
And was, roundly applauded by the congregation for making such a, as they interpreted, open and honest sort of stand. And they were sort of professing their love for him. And we do often see that in evangelical church settings, a pretty quick willingness to forgive, a desire for it all to be okay, you know, and especially someone who's been as beloved and influential as Bill Hybels. But at the same time, I am very heartened by the Me Too movement. I'm heartened that women are feeling gradually empowered to tell these stories and not to feel silenced or afraid to articulate this. I think we'll see more of that as time goes on. And churches will really have to deal very openly with that across the Protestant Catholic spectrum.
Where do you think we go from here?
Well, I'd like to see more of that, of sort of open and honest discussion and debate of these sorts of things. I'd like us to have a better national conversation about feminism and what these ideals are. It worries me that sometimes younger women think that, you know, they kind of have negative associations about feminism, even when they kind of live and express feminist ideals, as I see them anyway. So I think we really do need a big national reckoning about gender justice alongside racial justice and others. And I think we are seeing the beginning of that. I'm actually hopeful.
Marie Griffith is the author, most recently, of Moral Combat, How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics. Thanks for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks. It was a lot of fun.
The 21st is supported by the Beckman Institute for Advanced Science and Technology, presenting Sandra Singh Low, host of the NPR.org podcast, The Lowdown on Science, for the Smith Group JJR Lecture, noon on Friday, April 20th, in the Beckman Institute Auditorium.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Leaks, Twitter, tapes, these are some of the things political journalists are writing about in 2018 and how to do it, well, quickly and fairly. Even the best journalists are trying to figure that out. As Dan Baltz can tell you, he's the chief correspondent at the Washington Post. He's also a graduate of the University of Illinois, born here in Freeport. Dan was at the U of I yesterday to participate in a discussion about disruption, disinformation, and democracy, political reporting in the Trump era. And he's with me now in our studios at WILL. Hi, Dan. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So you recently wrote about the president's claims about illegal votes, which is something that we heard right after the election. But he brought this up again recently, and his notion that immigrants are voting many times for Democrats. And you wrote about the fact that a lot of people dismiss these claims. This one in particular, there's absolutely no facts to back this up, but that people often dismiss statements he makes like this as just grandstanding to his base. You think it's a little more nefarious than that, though?
Well, I do. I was struck by what he had to say last week. I mean, he started his administration by basically saying he would have won the popular vote had it not been for 3 to 5 million people who voted illegally. His implication was that it was undocumented immigrants who were casting illegal votes. There was no evidence for that. There's no evidence for widespread voter fraud in this country. There are occasional examples, but they're minuscule compared to the number of votes that are cast. And he was called on it by everybody, and he couldn't produce any evidence. The White House couldn't produce any evidence. But nonetheless, he established a commission that was designed to look at the broad issue of voter fraud and voter rolls and all of that. This was a commission that very quickly descended into partisan differences, but not just partisan differences. There were many state officials who were asked for information, Republicans and Democrats who oversee elections, who were unwilling to share as much as the commission seemed to want, because they were not convinced that the commission was going to use it to a good end. Ultimately, that commission got shut down. Again, no evidence that there had been widespread voter fraud of the kind that Donald Trump talked about. So he brought it up again last week. And, you know, as you suggested, you know, there are times when you can say, well, you know, we've heard this before, let's just ignore it. But my feeling then, early on and today, was that the more that this is done, the more it seeds distrust about something that's fundamental to a free society and to a democracy, which is the integrity of the voting system. And we know we're wrapped up in a discussion about what the Russians did in 2016 and the degree to which they may have hacked the vote. Again, not clear that they had any effect on that, but there are questions about the validity and the integrity of the electoral system. And I thought when the President of the United States continues to bring this up, it creates confusion and doubt about something that we should take for granted, which is that our voting systems are intact and fair and accurate. And so I thought it was worth again calling him out on it and saying, you know, he keeps saying these things, but they are not true and people should not take them for anything other than what they are.
We're talking politics, particularly in Washington, with Washington Post chief correspondent Dan Baltz, who's in studio with me. As always, you're welcome to join our conversation. If you have questions or comments for Dan, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to 21ST Show. And Dan, to that point, I don't know if you feel like it's accurate to say we're in sort of a post-truth era of journalism, particularly in Washington.
Well, I guess I would put it that we are in an era in which there are different opinions as to what truth actually is. You know, the president uses the term fake news, and fake news is what the Russians did. I mean, fake news was the Russians planting false stories and seeding them into the political system, injecting them in the political bloodstream through social media. When Donald Trump talks about fake news, what he is really talking about are stories that he doesn't like, and he therefore wants to label them as inaccurate. When we have a story as...
Say the Washington Post is frequently falls under the label of fake news.
Absolutely. I mean, he's attacked us numerous times. He's attacked the New York Times. He's attacked CNN and MSNBC and, you know, a variety of reputable news organizations. And he's often gone after us on stories in which we are quoting people but not identifying them by name, which is a standard practice in journalism. People are willing to share certain information if they can remain anonymous. It's in a sense the way we get whistleblower information about things going on in government that shouldn't be going on. It's a way to hold people in power accountable. But the president has labeled it as fake news. Now, we know the standards by which we operate repertorially and that those are real people and those are accurate quotes. But there are a lot of people today who do not believe much of what they see and read on television or in the media. This is not brand new, but it's worse today than it was. And I think that the president has contributed to that with these continual accusations about fake news. And so in that sense, we are kind of in a post-truth era. We're in a period in which it is more and more difficult to practice traditional journalism and convince people that it's real, that we have standards, that we have ethics, and that that the stories we print are accurate. I think the only shield we have is the degree to which those stories hold up over time. And I think if you look at the reporting we've done over the period of the Trump presidency or in other presidencies, those stories hold up. They are shown by events to have been accurate when they were written. And I think that's all we can do at this point is continue to operate the way we do.
Do you think journalists, especially in Washington, need to change the way that they operate? Or do you think we need to be more transparent about the way that we operate. And I think about, to your point about trust, certainly not just in our government and our electoral system, but in journalism, is not at a great point right now.
No, it's not. I mean, there's lack of faith in all institutions, and the press is at the
one of them.
We're one of them, and we're at a very low end of that scale, and we all recognize that, and it's concerning. And I think that you mentioned transparency. I think that's one element that we've tried to be cognizant of and tried to be more transparent. We're trying to be, you know, we try to let people know actually who we are as reporters. We try to be more transparent about the process, the processes by which we report stories. It's not well known by people. I mean, understandably, people don't know how.
Yeah, they don't know how we do what we do.
Right. And they don't know, I think, particularly the lengths to which we try to go to make sure that on a big story, that it is as accurate as it can possibly be. And we put a great deal of care into that. And we've had some stories over the last few months in which, you know, if we had the time, we could go into the painstaking work that went into making sure that every element of that story had been checked.
How does that work at the Washington Post? I wonder if we could spend a few minutes just talking about that. And if, for example, when a reporter writes a story, I know this from my newspaper background, but people who haven't worked in newspapers maybe don't know what goes into, in particular at the Washington Post, what it's like for a front page story, for example.
Yeah. Well, let me give you one example and an example that got a lot of attention. We had a story during the Alabama Senate election that Roy Moore, who was the Republican candidate, had sexual misconduct with a 14-year-old girl at the time. This was years past. And that he had sexual encounters and was dating or trying to date, you know, underage women when he was a young prosecutor in his 30s. That first story came from a tip to a reporter of ours who had gone down to Alabama simply to do a story about the supporters of Roy Moore. She wanted to get a flavor and draw a portrait of Roy Moore's base of support, which was not insubstantial, frankly. Along the way, she heard about this incident from years ago. From there, she reached out to try to talk to the woman. In the course of that, another reporter began to help on that story. They heard other examples. They found other women who were willing to talk. They spent some time, I mean, several weeks, trying to get the women to speak on the record rather than not with their names, because that makes a huge difference in the way the public accepts the story. One of our research people began to do thorough backgrounding on everything to make sure we understood where people were coming from.
Right, to look into people's criminal backgrounds, see if the people who are sharing your stories, that's what you mean by that.
Right, yes. You have to know that the people that you're, in essence, trusting are trustworthy. And we did that. The story was written. The story then went to our editors. The editors looked at it. They had questions. Ultimately, it went to our executive editor, Marty Baron. He had questions about it. And the goal was, we can't publish that story until absolutely everything in there is nailed down. So it was a process. It's not that we just heard this tip and rushed it into print. We spent a long time making sure that that story was airtight.
I'm speaking with Dan Baltz. He's chief correspondent for The Washington Post. And I wonder, we haven't talked about the role of technology in all of this. And Facebook has been in the news this week a lot. You alluded to this earlier. CEO Mark Zuckerberg was before Congress. And there's a lot we know, and I should say there's a lot we don't know, about how much there was outside interference in our democratic process. But what do you think about organizations like Facebook, when we think about the fake news that was seeded through Facebook? Do you think of Facebook as a media outlet?
Well, we certainly use Facebook to try to leverage through social media to find a bigger audience for our stories. And it's enormously important in that way. We know that people are more likely to read a Washington Post story if a Facebook friend of theirs tells them to read it than they are to just find it on the Washington Post website. It is a powerful element of the way information is transmitted today. In many ways, Facebook is a news provider. They have resisted accepting that as the definition of what they are, but that is one of the things they do. What we found out is that Facebook, and I suspect lots of other places, but Facebook because it has 2 billion people who use it, that Facebook was vulnerable to misuse and abuse by, you know, the Russians. And there are, you know, there are examples of that, and the special prosecutor's indictment of the Russians, of 13 Russians, went in great detail into the kinds of things they were trying to do on social media and in other ways. And I think it has taken Facebook a long time to come to terms with exactly what happened. I'm not sure they know everything that happened, but we know that they were used by the Russians in ways that nobody understood at the time, and that it was an assault on the democratic system, on democracy, and an attempt, in addition, as the special prosecutor and the intelligence agency said, in addition to being an effort to help Donald Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton, or certainly hurt Hillary Clinton in an effort to help Donald Trump, that it was also designed to sow doubt about our system. And Facebook is trying to, you know, make amends and tighten up their system. But it's enormously difficult, as Mark Zuckerberg's testimony showed this week.
And I wonder if you think that part of this is also a theme of tech companies also not wanting to give themselves a label that maybe reflects what their role is that they're playing right now in society. How much you think that's part of the problem?
Well, I think they want to avoid regulation, you know, that would,
like any company would.
Like any company, right. They're not unique in that way. And it's, you know, it's not easy to think through, okay, if they should be regulated, in what ways? And I certainly don't have the answers, because I know it would be a very, very complex question, because, you know, on the one hand, you do not want to shut off or shut down the ability of people to interact with one another, to create communities. We know there are a lot of good things that can produce. But the question of what those gigantic companies, we know they, in a sense, kind of rule our lives now, whether it's, you know, Google or Facebook or whatever. They know tons about us. We don't know quite how they use that information. I think everybody recognizes there is, you know, a gradual and steady loss of privacy. How do you balance all of those kinds of things? We in a sense, willingly and sometimes unwillingly give up a lot of information to these companies, and we have, you know, what kind of level of confidence do we have that this is being used for good ends and not for bad?
I wonder how you think this changes. I don't know if any of this changes the message. You're here at the University of Illinois, your alma mater. What you tell student journalists about those young people who are going into the industry now?
Well, I mean, they've grown up with this in a way that I certainly didn't. I mean, the Internet didn't exist when I was at the University of Illinois. So in a sense, they are more used to it and more accepting of it. And frankly, more, you know, they have a greater facility with it. So I don't, in a sense, tell them what to do. Marty Baron, our executive editor, had a great line some time ago. He said, we used to, news organizations like The Post, we used to hire young people for what we could teach them. And now we hire young people for what they can teach us. And there is a lot of truth to that. The Post newsroom is filled with very young, very talented people who have a intuitive sense of how you use technology and social media and all of the tools that are now available. What I tell young journalists is, you know, the fundamentals of journalism are not changed. The processes of getting that information out to people may be different. Every technological advancement in the history of the world has led to a different way in which we communicate and a different way in which news organizations, quote unquote, distribute their information. But at heart, what good journalism is what it's always been. It is an effort to find the truth. It is an effort to shine a bright light on misbehavior by people in power. It is telling stories and bringing people together through that storytelling, and it's an effort to do it in a painstaking way.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Washington Post chief correspondent Dan Baltz. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is supported by the University of Illinois Press, hosting the Association of University Press's annual book, jacket, and journal show in the Link Gallery at the School of Art and Design, April 2nd through the 13th. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years.
Listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Washington Post political reporter, chief correspondent Dan Baltz. He's a University of Illinois grad back in town to address journalism students at the university, in studio with us now. Dan, I wanted to ask you about, I know in the past you've written books about the Republican Party, and I'm thinking in particular about that was the Newt Gingrich era. How much you think Republican politics have changed in the mid-90s. You're smiling. That was a long time ago, and the party is really looks very different now, do you think?
You know, it's remarkable because when we I wrote that book with a friend, Ron Brownstein. When we wrote that book, which we wrote in 1995 after the 94 sweep by the Republicans in the congressional elections, we talked about the change in the Republican Party at that point from what it had been to the hard-charging Gingrich, hard-edged conservative movement. Donald Trump has changed all of that. All parties evolve. I mean, they're not static organizations, and so they change with the times, and they particularly change after they've lost. But the Republican Party today is I describe it as a party of three parts. One is the traditional establishment. Paul Ryan, the speaker who just announced he's not going to run again, represents that traditional establishment. Then there is the kind of the Tea Party wing of the party, the Freedom Caucus in the House of Representatives. They represent a different kind of Republican and conservative view, and particularly a view about government, what government ought to be or ought not to be, the role of Congress in particular. And then there's Donald Trump's Republican Party, because Donald Trump does not have a consistent or in a sense, a clear ideological point of view. On some issues, he's where Bernie Sanders is. And on many other issues, he's where traditional Republicans are. But what's happened is that Donald Trump, because he is the president of the United States, is redefining the Republican Party. And I think that the Paul Ryans of the world have learned that as much as they have tried to kind of hold fast to the principles that they believed in and believe should be at the heart of Republicanism, Donald Trump has a different view of that. And so the tension within the Republican Party is profound at this point. And there are many Republicans I won't say older generation, but of that older style, who feel they don't have a home right now in the Trump Republican Party.
And that said, we just have about a minute left, but I wonder if you could just briefly answer how you think Donald Trump has changed the Democratic Party and where you think, because I think if you look at the Democratic Party, it's not necessarily clear what the Democratic Party stands for either.
No, it isn't. And I think that's one of the challenges for the Democrats right now. It is very easy to be the party of opposition to Donald Trump. That goes without saying that a party out of power will oppose the president. And this is a president that many Democrats like to oppose. I mean, they find him distasteful in a lot of ways. And so they've done that. But there is a question about what they really stand for, and not only what they stand for, but how they articulate that. And that that was, I think, one of the things that caused problems for Secretary Clinton in 2016. She had a lot of ideas about programs she wanted to do, but she wasn't able to convey that in a compelling way, in contrast to a phrase like Make America Great Again, which had real power and resonance with a particular part of the electorate. I think Democrats are going through a period in which they have shifted more to the left. The party that nominated Hillary Clinton is not the party that Bill Clinton presided over. That battle is yet to play out. How far left will the Democrats shift in 2018, and particularly as they pick a nominee in 2016? In 2020.
Yeah, we'll see how all of that plays out. I know you'll be reporting on it. I want to thank you for being with us. Dan Baltz with The Washington Post. Thanks for being here, Dan.
Thank you very much, Nyla.
Drug overdoses are now the leading cause of death for people under 50, according to the CDC. Nowadays, we often hear that we're in an opioid crisis, and we know that many people become addicted by taking pills that are either prescribed or bought over the counter. Now, Illinois State Police is teaming up with the Save a Star Drug Awareness Foundation to try to fight prescription drug and opioid abuse by making it easier for people to discard their unwanted medication through housing receptacles. To hear more about this initiative, we're joined on the line right now by Sergeant Jacqueline Cepeda from the Illinois State Police. Sergeant Cepeda, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
It's our pleasure. Thank you very much.
How often does ISP deal with issues of prescription drug abuse or overdoses?
You know, our officers in our line of work, our officers deal with and come across overdose victims regularly. Since 2015, all our troopers are now, who are assigned to patrol, are equipped and trained in the use of Narcan. And since 2015, our officers have been able to save 30 lives using this life-saving medication.
Right. So that's Narcan. That's a drug for overdoses. What's the idea behind implementing this drug receptacle program?
Well, the Illinois State Police, we reached out to Mr. David Katz, his family, and the Save a Star Drug Awareness Foundation. We wanted to partner up with them and obtain the drug collection receptacles to place at some of our ISP headquarters throughout the state. You know, we are aware of the current opioid epidemic occurring around the country and of the negative effects it's having on people and their families. And we wanted to place these receptacles at some of our headquarters to give people a way to properly and safely dispose of their unwanted medication. Our hopes are that by having these receptacles, that this will keep drugs out of the hands of individuals who might otherwise potentially become victims of prescription drug abuse.
So what are you accepting? What's the process look like?
So we are accepting. So we currently have 5 receptacles that the Save a Star Drug Awareness Foundation generally donated to us. The 5 locations are the District Chicago location, which is located in Des Plaines, District 2, which is located in Elgin, District 5 in Joliet, District 17 in LaSalle, and District 11, which is located in Collinsville. And the items that are accepted are prescription medications, including controlled substances, all over-the-counter and PET medications, sample medications, vitamins, liquids, and creams can be dropped off. And the items that are not accepted are needles, sharp objects, thermometers, IV bags, hydrogen peroxide, and bloody waste, things of that nature.
And are you just taking prescription medications then?
No, it can be over-the-counter medication, PET medication, anything of that sort.
And will you all be checking to see if people have prescriptions for these medications, or is this just kind of a situation where people can just hand them over to you?
We will not be checking. So the process to turn in the unwanted medications is very simple. The public can go to any one of the 5 district headquarters where we have the drug collection receptacles, gain access to the box, which is a large green container that looks very similar to a mailbox. They can simply use the handle, open the mailbox, and drop off their medications into the containers with no questions asked. We want people to feel comfortable and safe when disposing of these unwanted medications or over-the-counter drugs, and we will not be asking them any questions about the medications they are disposing of.
Sergeant Cepeda, what are you guys going to do with the medication when you get it?
Our evidence technicians in each of the districts, they ensure to get rid of all the same way we get rid of other evidence, to dispose of the unwanted medications in a safe manner.
And you mentioned there are 5 locations throughout the state. Do you have plans to expand this to other locations as well?
At this time, we only currently have the 5 drug receptacles that the Katz family and the Save a Star Drug Awareness Foundation very generously donated to the Illinois State Police.
While we're talking about this, I wonder what other programs the Illinois State Police has to deal with opioid and prescription drug abuse throughout Illinois.
You know, so currently, as I got a chance to briefly mention earlier, since 2015, the department made sure that all of our troopers who are assigned to patrol, who deal with these overdose victims on a more regular basis than the other officers, that they were trained with and equipped in the use of Narcan. Like you mentioned earlier, Narcan is a nasal spray medication that we're equipped with, which is used to reverse the side effects of an opioid overdose. And since 2015, when our officers were trained and equipped with the Narcan, we've been able to administer the Narcan to 30 overdose victims using this medication, and in turn being able to save their life while they were having the overdose.
Mm-hmm. So, more work the Illinois State Police is doing to combat the opioid crisis that we are going through. Sergeant Cepeda, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us.
For anyone listening who suffers from a severe food allergy, or if you know someone who does, you know it's something you cannot take lightly. From snacks at school to hidden ingredients at restaurants, you always have to be on high alert. What's often even more frustrating about food allergies is the lack of understanding about where they come from. Well, there's new research from Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine that's giving us a more of a clue about the causes of infant and childhood food allergies, which affect anywhere, according to the CDC, to 4 to 6% of children in the U.S. The study was recently published in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology, and its lead author is in our studio at Evanston's Medill School of Journalism in Northwestern. Joan Cook-Mills, a professor in the Allergy and Immunology Department at the university. Hi, Joan. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Joan, what were you trying to find out about food allergies in your study?
We were looking for mechanisms for development of the food allergy early in life, early in infancy, and equivalent to childhood. We used a mouse model that has the same gene mutations that is found in human eczema. So in human eczema, there are gene mutations that lead to skin barrier difficulties. And there's also an association of eczema with food allergy. Mm-hmm. So we used mice that had the same gene mutations and then looked early in life exposures on the skin that could induce food allergy, and we found a combination of four factors. One is the genetic mutation. Second one is exposure to food on the skin. So we used food allergens. We either used peanut or chicken egg ovalbumin. It's a protein in chicken egg. And then the third component was exposures to environmental allergens that are found in the dust. A couple of the different ones that we tried were house dust mites, or it's a mold called Alternaria alternata. It's a mold that's common. It's used for rotting plants. It's ubiquitous in our environment and also found in the house dust. And the fourth component was a surfactant or soap. And the soap helped with delivery of the allergen into the skin. So it helped with the absorption of the allergen into the skin.
So you looked at four. So it sounds like you looked at four different things, right? So you looked
at the same time.
Yeah. So you looked at people who have a genetic mutation, maybe a predisposition to having this.
That's correct.
And then you tested these different specific allergens. What did you learn from that then?
The combination of those four factors induced early in life food allergy in the mice model. And if any one of those factors is left out, food allergy did not develop.
So it
required all four.
So the main testing for this research was done on mice. How does that translate over to what you want human parents to be worried about?
Eczema is associated with food allergy, and these exposures to the mice are common household exposures. And so it is a potential modifiable factor or factors that could be altered in the environment, and further testing and understanding for humans needs to be done. But these are modifiable factors, including rinsing to remove soap or washing your hands before handling the child so you don't put food on the skin of those susceptible children.
So for children who might be susceptible to allergies, for infants, parents need to be really careful about, for example, peanuts exposure. You're saying dust exposure, kind of common allergens, but then also
dust
soap?
Dust is ubiquitous. I think that's a difficult one.
Okay. So you're saying more food, and then it sounds like soap as well. So
soap helps the absorption. So rinse the soap off.
Thank you so much for joining us. That's Joan Cook-Mills. She's a professor of allergy and immunology at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine, joining us from Northwestern in Evanston. Thank you for being with me.
Thank you so much.
That does it for us today and for this week. Next week, we're going to be broadcasting live from Bloomington Normal. If you're in the area, we'd love to have you come attend the show. We're going to be at the Coffee Hound on East Washington Street on Monday and at the Green Top Grocery on Wednesday, both live at our usual time at 11 o'clock. So come by and say hello. We'd love to meet you. We'll be partnering with our friends at WGLT, our partner station. Thanks to them for hosting us for the week. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa and NPR One, you can play us there. All you have to do is say, Alexa, ask NPR One to play The 21st. You do have to have NPR One enabled. Directions for how to do that are at our website. Follow us on Twitter. Search for 21ST Show. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. You search for our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on, or you can post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All of those links, every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, if you want to send us an email, or follow us on social media, as I said, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Fatima Farha is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.